Welcome to Pop Culture Retro, which was recently voted the 15th best podcast by the residents of the Golden Years Retirement Community in Boca Raton, Florida. Each show, we'll revisit some of your favorite pop culture memories with insider and outsider perspectives. Now, please help me welcome your hosts, Ike Eisenman and Jonathan Rosen.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Pop Culture Retro. I'm one of your hosts, Jonathan Rosen, along with Ike Eisenman. And today we are thrilled to welcome one of the longest tenured writers for Mad Magazine. He was also the original writer for the legendary game show Match Game, as well as the co-host of the podcast The Daily Gizwiz, and author of the memoir Good Days in Mad, and most importantly, a fellow Brooklynite. Please help us welcome Dick DiBartolo. Dick, thanks so much for joining us.
No, this is great fun. I've been looking forward to this for 45 minutes.
That's a little bit longer than that. But we have a lot to cover, so we're going to try to get as much as possible. But to start with, as we mentioned, you grew up in Brooklyn. Did your parents write at all? And when did you first realize that you had a talent for writing?
My father ran a machine shop and was... he kept saying, "What do you want to be?" And I said, "A writer." And he goes, "A writer is not an occupation. An occupation needs tools." So I guess I started knowing I wanted to write because I was doing stuff for the high school newspaper. And I was reading Mad. So I then sent something to Mad, which they bought. And so, and my mother, when my father was not there, my mother would say to me, "Listen, you do whatever you want. You don't have to pay any attention to your father." So neither one of them were in the entertainment business.
I'll have to say that I'm a writer, and some days I feel your father was right. But
well, who were some of your influences growing up?
Well, you know what? It's very interesting. I never read any books when I was, but I used to read The New Yorker, and sometimes Woody Allen would have something in there. I especially the cartoons. I loved the cartoons, and I liked all the cartoons in the Sunday papers. And as I said, I started reading Mad really early on, and then after reading it for a while, I thought, you know, I'd rather write this than read this. So,
so you were a big fan as a kid. You were a big fan.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Who were some of your favorites in Mad, by the way? Just curious.
My favorites, say again?
Your favorites in Mad. Some of your favorite writers.
Oh, well, I Don Martin, without a doubt. I also love the Folden and Larry Siegel and Stan Hart, because they did the movie satires, a lot of them back then. And also Arnie Kogan, who also did a lot of Mad movie satires.
So how did you wind up working there?
Well, I sent this article in, and I had read that you have to send a self-addressed stamped envelope, because if it's rejected, they'll just throw it out if there's not an envelope. So my envelope came back, and I thought, oh, maybe there's a thing that says try again. Or anyway, the envelope was stuffed with cardboard, and it said, "Ha ha, thought this was your script being returned. Staple to this cardboard is a check for $100. And wow, please call us about writing for, more stuff." And it was signed by Nick Meglin.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, associate editor. And then he and John Ficarra became co-editors. So it was a Mad start to working at Mad.
Oh, that's crazy. So what were some of your first responsibilities there? And do you remember the first thing?
Well, you know what? I freelanced for an incredible amount of time. I did takeoffs on commercials. And then I had written some material for two guys who had just gotten out of the Air Force, and they wanted a sketch about the armed services, and I wrote it, and one of them liked it and the other one hated it. So the one who liked it was John Biner, the comedian. He said, "I'll pay you my half."
Oh, wow.
But my partner doesn't want to do this. I gave it to Nick Meglin and I said, "Is this terrible?" And I told him the story. And he said, "You know what? Rewrite this as a movie script and we'll just do it as a Mad classic. It'll just be Mad Presents the Air Force movie." And then people liked that. So I did one about submarines. And he said, "You know what? I think you should start being in the circle that doing satires on feature films." And that got me into the Poop Side Down adventure and the Towering Sterno, and started doing the big things in Mad.
I remember reading the Poop Side Down one actually at the time. I remember reading
Good. Yeah.
Yes. So you just like you mentioned, you wrote a lot of the TV and movie spoofs. So, and Mad always used to post, I remember, these pictures of the celebrities reading the spoofs about them. Were there any occasions where celebrities would write it and complain about the treatment that they got?
There was only, I had a really very fortunate thing, because while working for Mad, I was also writing game shows.
Right.
And it would often happen that I would meet the people that were, you know, it was, let's see, Lost in Space was, what was the woman? Jane, who was the star of Lost in Space? Oh, anybody remember? Wow. Anyway.
Yeah.
I said, "You know, I just had to take off on your show. I think it was called Loused Up in Space." And I gave her a copy and she read it on lunch break. And she said, "Do you know someone at the show?" And I said, "No, why?" She said, "Well, your plot is very similar to something we're going to tape like 3 months from now." I said, "Oh, okay. Well, this is great. This is great that I actually got on the same line that you are." But
is it Alan June Lockhart? Alda, is that it? June Lockhart?
June Lockhart. Yes. Yes, it was June Lockhart. But Alan Alda was on and he said, "You know, you work for Mad, right?" This is backstage. And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "You know, I think they were very unfair to MASH in their satire." And I said, "You know what? I didn't write that, but let me tell you a little bit of background. When we satirize a sitcom, it is very hard to do because you guys are doing all the best jokes. And so we have to kind of find a fault or take something that's so-so and make it into a fault just so there's something to write about." And I said, "Alan, the only reason MASH is in Mad because your ratings are through the roof and we have to satirize things that are wildly popular, as your show is." And he said, "Oh, my God, I'm so glad I spoke to you. I feel better now." So that's the only one that I know of that complained about.
Wow.
Well, it's nice you had a moment with them, because those things can eat up people. You know?
Yeah, yeah. It's fascinating. It is fascinating.
Yeah. Well, at what point did you go from having to get approval for everything to basically having a regular feature and being in charge?
You know, there was a, I forgot what it was. There was a satire that Al Feldstein called me in and said, "You know, we need this script punched up because it's just a little flat. Is it possible you can do that?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "The problem is we need it on Monday." I said, "Okay." And he goes, "Today is Friday." I said, "Yeah, I have the whole weekend." So I did it. And then I thought the jokes didn't it looked a little jerky, so I just wrote a whole new script. Anyway, Bill called me in and he said, listen, this was great what you did over the weekend, and Al was very happy. Can we do anything for you? And I said, I just want to be in every issue. And he said, well, that's simple. Just keep writing. And so I kept writing and had enough stuff to get in every issue for almost 50 years.
Wow, amazing. Mm. Going back to, like you said about Alan Alda getting upset, I'm just curious, were there any stories that maybe got turned down because they were worried that it might upset somebody the wrong way?
No.
No, nothing.
No. And the funny thing is, people would say, oh, you must get invited to all the previews. We never got invited to previews. The only time you would get an invite to a preview is when the studio knew it was going to be a terrible movie. And they figured, let's at least get mad to satirize it. That'll maybe get someone to go to the theater.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, no, MAD really sort of operated totally independently. And again, the Goodson Todman background had a lot of benefits for me, because for Mort Drucker and Jack Davis, they needed reference for what the stars looked like. And you couldn't call us MAD magazine and said, we want the press kit, because they would know instantly that you're going to trash their movie. But if I would call from Goodson and just say, hey, you know, I'm over here at Goodson Todman and they're talking about maybe somebody from the movie being on one of our shows, you just get me the complete press kit. And then I would just bring it over to MAD.
Oh, man. Well, when we had Sergio Aragonés on.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. He spoke about some of the legendary vacation writing retreats that the staff took. Do you have any behind the scenes of MAD?
Sergio and I had a great time because we both knew judo, and we did this twice where Sergio, I think it was Puerto Rico, Sergio said, why don't we have a fight out at the pool? And I said, oh, okay. I said, I'll go out and take a lounge chair, and then you come over and say that was your lounge chair, and then we'll just fight on the lawn and I'll knock you in the swimming pool. And we did that, and we did it another time. I forgot what it was, but we had a lot of fun with that. Sergio was very, very, very good at getting into with the staff. And at a dinner, maybe in Paris, Bill ordered whatever he ordered, roast beef or something. And he said, can I get a touch more gravy? And the guy pours gravy on it and goes, thank you. And the guy pours more gravy on it and said, no, that's enough gravy. And the guy pours more gravy on it. And Bill says, are you going to, Sergio, how did you get a waiter's uniform?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. He was just great at that. And then we were at some other place where there was a picket line, and some of the guys were taking pictures of the picketing. And who's in the front of the line carrying a picket sign? Sergio. So Sergio was very funny. And great at doing practical jokes.
Fascinating guy too. Yes.
Yes.
Now, I'm curious also, Matt had other vehicles like associated with them during their time, like, you know, Mad TV or the movie Up the Academy. Has anyone at the magazine had any say in content when that happens? Or
no. No. The Mad TV was a licensing deal, mm-hmm, where they licensed, I think, Don Martin stuff and could use the name. And it's very funny because when Mad TV started, my agent called them and said, I represent a writer who does a lot of the movie satire. And the guy at the other end said, you know what? I don't know why I have to say this, but we were told we should not hire anybody from MAD.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. I know. Backstage story, I think it was because the company that did it had approached Bill many times about licensing MAD's name, and Bill would never do it. And I think like the day Bill died, they made a deal directly with Warner. And then, like, I guess it's revenge. They figured we don't want anybody from MAD involved with us. So it's just a licensing deal.
Why did people who've been doing this for years and years, right?
Yes, exactly. Why do we want some from MAD Magazine on the MAD show? Right. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Well, it's Hollywood. It makes perfect sense to me.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Well, you had already mentioned that you were writing for television at during your early days at MAD. How did that first come about?
I had a friend who worked for Goodson Todman, and he said, you know, we're doing this show called Match Game, and he said they need sort of lighthearted questions. And he said, you know, why don't you come in for an interview? So I went in, and they told me what it was. And I don't know if you've ever seen, I think only 1 week of the original year of shows exist. But
right, I read this.
Yes, the questions were, name a red bird, name something you do with an egg, name a car that's no longer made. Those were the questions. And 10 months in, Goodson called me in and he said, listen, NBC's not picking up the contract. He said, you still have 2 months of shows, but I'm just telling you now in case you want to put feelers out for work. And then over the weekend, I thought, you know, this show is kind of fun, but the questions are dreary. And I thought, how could I punch this up? And then I wrote a few Match Game questions. And the very first one, which I bounced off Goodson, I said, Mark, why don't we just do silly questions like, Mary liked to pour gravy on John's blank. And so Goodson laughs and he goes, well, that's funny, but what will they say? I said, they'll say meatloaf. They'll say mashed potatoes. He said, well, it's canceled. Do what you want. So I started doing those. And the first couple of shows, we just did like straight question, blanks, straight. And then Goodson called me in after a few weeks and he goes, you know what? He said, the rating is picking up and NBC is in for another year. So just keep writing those questions. So it stayed in New York for about the first 6 years. And then he said, listen, there's something new coming out called syndication. And I'm moving the show to California. Do you want to go to California? I'll move you out there. I said, Mark, I was born in Brooklyn and I live in Manhattan. I have a boat. He said, well, I'm keeping these offices on the East Coast. He said, as long as there's a Match Game, you'll have a job. And then he went and died and I lost my job. But he said, listen, syndication's going to take a year or two. Pick another Goodson Todman show and just tell them that Mark said you're hired. So I went over and I worked on To Tell the Truth for a while and What's My Line for a while. So it's great.
It's amazing because really, I mean, people don't realize it, but you single-handedly saved Matt King. I mean, you
were
the one responsible.
Yeah, no, I know. People often say, God, if they had given you like one half of 1% of that show, you would be set for life because, you know, it runs in other countries and it's blankety blank overseas. But yeah, no, but I gave myself 18 years of employment too. So,
yeah, well, not too bad. Well, what was Mark Goodson like?
Oh, Mark Goodson was not a laugh riot. I don't know. He was very serious. From time to time, I would do a practical joke. He invited us to his house once. And he had original art on all the walls. And he said, oh, the Matisse, I'm sorry, the Matisse is not here, but I lent it to the Louvre and they gave me this Rembrandt. I mean, it was, you cannot believe his house. And anyway, on pretext on something, I took out my wallet. And back in those days, they had, you know, all the photos on this thing. And every one of them was a picture of Mark Goodson. And I said, oh, Mark, I'm so sorry. I'm embarrassed that people know how much I love your work. Anyway, so he did smile at that.
I also want to ask about, you know, Gene Rayburn. You know, it's amazing to me because as you read more about him, I was like shocked that he was a song and dance man, that he was also in the first version of The Tonight Show. What were your thoughts about him? How did you get
Gene was very talented. He filled in for several months on Broadway for Dick.
Dick Van Dyke, yeah.
Dick Van Dyke and Bye Bye Birdie.
Mm. Yeah. I never would have thought that. That's amazing.
No, yeah. No, you know, and he started here. I knew him first as a DJ. He was on WNEW here, Rayburn and Finch, and he was very funny. And we used to get in trouble with Goodson because on the original match game, after about five questions when no one matched anything during the commercial, Rayburn would say, Dick, come on camera, do anything. We're dying out here. And I would just get up and start walking across the stage. And he goes, excuse me, sir, can I help you? This is a game show. We're on the air. I said, oh, I'm playing golf out in the hall. Didn't the ball come through here? And then Gene would call me and go, Goodson had a fit that we did that. He said, it's a game show. It's not a comedy show. But then the new match game, suddenly I think Goodson realized how funny Gene could be and let him do whatever he wanted. The terrible thing about Gene was when they brought match game back and didn't hire him.
Yeah.
He was brokenhearted. Every time we would meet, he would say, never, ever tell anybody your age. He said, when That's Entertainment Tonight said, happy birthday, Gene Rayburn, you're 65 today. Gene said, my career ended.
Mm.
And so I always felt bad that he had such a sad ending when he was so wildly popular during Match Game's heyday.
And none of the other hosts were as good as him either.
No, and it would drive him crazy because evidently Family Feud. Help me with names here. I'm suddenly dropping. Who hosted Richard Dawson. Had signed a contract for like five times Gene's salary.
No.
And he said, oh my God, do you know what they're paying him and what they're paying me? And so I always felt bad because Gene was, he was great.
After you made the change, you said that the ratings picked up with the change in format of questions.
Yes.
How long did it take for you to start seeing those ratings pick up?
Just a month or so. Because it turned out that Match Game became incredibly popular with students, high school and college kids. And because it was on at 4 o'clock, so kids were just getting home from school. And there was enough point rating going up over, I guess it would be enough to get 6 weeks of ratings to know that something was happening over at Match Game.
Well, so now back to during this time, you're working simultaneously at Mad and Match Game.
Yes.
What was that schedule like for you?
Well, the thing is with Mad, you could go in anytime, because while Match Game was on, I was still freelancing. I was not, even when I was creative consultant over at MAD, it was just 2 days a week. The great thing was the offices were one block apart. Goodson Todman was on 52nd and Park. Actually, they were in the Seagram building that was a block long. And MAD was at 52nd and Madison. So they're one short block apart. So I could run between the two of them with ease if there was a meeting at either place.
That's great.
Yeah, so it was great. It was great.
So let's go back, because Match Game had so many versions. So the first one you were on was the 60s version.
Yes.
Where it first started trying, you know, change the questions. So the show was doing well in the ratings and all throughout the 60s. And then NBC abruptly cancels it in 69. So what reason was given back then? And how did all of you feel about that then?
You know what? This might have been after they changed the time slot, because somebody thought it would work better as a morning show. And it went from 4 in the afternoon, I believe, till 11 a.m. And just died. So I think that was probably the main reason that it just suddenly ended, because our audience was the people who were there after school.
Right. Well, how soon after the cancellation did you start hearing that CBS was interested in reviving it? And were you shocked to see it come back?
Well, I think what they wanted is, the networks were looking for something that was similar, I guess, to Hollywood. What's the one with the nine boxes?
Hollywood Squares.
Hollywood Squares. And so Goodson said, when the show comes back, we're going with six celebrities and just two contestants. You know, the original show was four contestants and two celebrities. And so I think CBS thought that that would be a big draw, and it was. It was very successful in the new version. And I went out like for the first 3 weeks, and then I would just write questions here, and we had something called the Daily Pouch, which was a FedEx bag that went that Goodson, the guy in the mailroom said, did you know that Goodson sends his dirty laundry out once a week in the pouch from LA to New York, because he has a French laundress in New York and he likes the way they do the laundry. And I'm thinking, that's money, where you send your laundry cross country.
Yeah, absolutely. My gosh. So you mailed in the questions for the new show.
Okay. Yeah, I just dropped them in the pouch. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Was wondering how that worked.
No, just drop. Just say, Ricky would say, "You have anything for the pouch? The pouch is going out at 5 p.m." And I had a day of the week. I think I was in on the third Thursday pouch. I forgot what it was, but once a week the stuff would go out.
Okay.
And then they had three. They added three writers in California. I was just one of the writers after it went out there.
Did you have any say in what questions would be used, or no?
No. Mine just went out there, and they did what they wanted.
Also, when the new version started, the one in California, would they change it to six, six celebrities? Were you privy at all to any of the decisions making that was going on regarding cast? I mean, Richard Dawson was one of the first ones cast then. So what led producers to him? Do you know?
I do not know. I know that Ira Scutch, who was producing back then, it was very funny because Jack Klugman was on the very first episode of the new Match Game. And a couple of weeks after the show, Jack Klugman called Ira Scutch and said, "Can you put my wife," Brett Summers was his wife, "can you put her on just one single show, because she's driving me crazy. She wants to do it." And Ira said, well, we only book for a week at a time. We'll certainly put her on for a week. And of course, that suddenly became magic for the game show when Brett and Charles ended up next to each other. They just hit it off. And Ira said a couple of weeks later, Jack Klugman called me and said, thank you so much for putting Brett on. And Ira said, what are you kidding? Thank you. She's amazing. That her and Charles are the best. So no, but I, outside of that, I had no clue as to who they were using.
And Charles came in because of his association with Gene Rayburn from Broadway?
I believe so, but I'm not 100% sure. Yeah, Charles had a big Broadway career too.
Yeah. Now, the 70s version, though, that's the one that's really associated with the risque questions and the double entendres.
Yes.
So how much did the censors become involved in it? And were there any questions that they said, no, you can't do that?
Well, we never knew, but the thing, the object was to write we would call them the pure filth questions. The questions you knew they would go, are they freaking crazy? And you did like four or five of those. So when they got to the other ones, they would go, oh, well, this is okay. Because by comparison, it would look mild. And only one of them that I thought are they crazy questions did get on the air and did go by the census. And it was Unlucky Louie was so unlucky. And then the audience would scream, how unlucky was he? Unlucky Louie was so unlucky when he went on a diet. It's funny now. When he went on a diet, he lost 2 inches, but he didn't lose it from his waist. He lost it from his blank. And that did get on. And people said his hair, his nose, his height. Yeah, so, and boobs. Ira tells the story that he was in the control room with someone from Standards and Practices, and the card came up and it said boobs. And Ira turned to the Standards and Practices guy and said, stop the show or can go on. And the Standards and Practices guy had brought his wife, and he said to his wife, boobs, that she said, well, that's silly. That's funny. And so boobs became the answer. And Diane Jennifer, with the contestants, they had a whole list. You don't say breasts, you say boobs. You don't say took a leak, you say tinkle. You don't say ass, you say bum. I forgot what it was, but it was like a whole ritual of what you could say and not say.
That seems insane.
Wow. Well, we've had several people on our show who appeared on Hollywood Squares, and people, even I didn't realize it growing up, that a week's worth of episodes were all filmed on the same day.
Yes.
And that there's a marked difference in the episodes that were shown on Thursday and Friday because of drinking at lunch. So do you have any stories that come to mind from people under the influence?
No, just the fact that, yes, it was less prevalent in New York. Because, and I'll tell you the reason. In New York, we were in the RCA building, where NBC was, and lunch break, I think, was an hour and a half or 2 hours. And there are a million restaurants around. When the show went to TV City, they didn't want the celebrities, six of them, leaving because they probably have to drive somewhere to get food. So they thought, let's just have food brought in every day. And that way the celebrities just stay in the studio during the break. And they started serving wine during the lunch. And so that's where the two afternoon shows. In New York, we did 2 in the morning and 3 in the afternoon. I'm not even sure if that held true for LA. But that's why the afternoon shows are sillier than the morning shows.
That's great. So watching the documentary, and I watched it again this week. I'd seen it many times, the documentary, you know, the match came behind the blank.
Yes.
There seemed like there was tension at some points between Richard Dawson and the show, and also Richard Dawson and the rest of the cast, like a lot of jealousy maybe from the other panelists with Richard in general.
Yes.
So you were mostly across the country, but were you aware of everything going on in that dynamic?
You know what? I only know from Ira Scutch, that Richard Dawson was feeling, oh, I know what started it. Oh, okay, I remember now. When they would have the winning contestant would play for the $500 whatever it was, the super match at the end of of winning the game, and 90% of the time they would call on Richard Dawson to give the answer because Richard Dawson was excellent at coming up with the right match. The problem was the other celebrities were starting to think that they're not part of the end of the show. So they came up with the celebrity wheel to the winning contestant would spin the wheel and the six celebrity names were on it. And that person would try to match the contestant. Well, evidently, Richard Dawson had a fit about this and started being very petulant on the set. And Ira said after a couple of weeks, I said to him, Richard, if you want off the show, I can easily arrange that. And so Richard Dawson said, okay. And he left the show. But it was his being offended that they were not letting him, I guess, get chosen all the time.
But the other celebrities were annoyed with Richard?
Yes. You know, probably the only ones that were annoyed were probably like Brett and Charles because they were sort of the other permanent guests.
Right.
But and Ira thought it was better for the game, too, that there was more variety, that automatically it wasn't Richard every time. So, yeah.
Well, was anyone at the show upset when Richard left?
Boy, you know, I wasn't out there, but Ira never said anything about things being terribly different after Richard left. Gene was probably happy.
Well, you worked with Richard in Family Feud as well, right?
Yes, I wrote stuff for Family Feud.
How did that go? How did that whole experience then go?
That was the same thing, sending questions. And for a while, Goodson called me one day and he said, didn't you write stuff for Rayburn when he did The Tonight Show? And I said, yeah. He said, I'm trying to talk him out of it, but Richard Dawson wants to do a mini monologue at the beginning of Family Feud. And he said, just think about what kind of thing he might do or something. And then Goodson said, he said, you know what, I managed to tell him it's a game show. And although you can be crazy and nutty on the show, it doesn't make sense you would start a game show with a mini monologue. So.
Oh, God. You didn't have much interaction with Richard, wouldn't you?
No, none. But none. Rayburn, yes. You know, The Tonight Show.
I saw the clip of you going out on The Tonight Show when Rayburn hosted. That was hysterical. When you did the pratfall?
Yeah. So he called me in. He called me up one Monday and he said, you know, I'm hosting the show this week. He said, three of the writers didn't come in. And the two that are here, he said, I know these jokes because I heard Johnny do them. And he said, they really only want to write for Carson. He said, if you come in, I'll just pay you out of my own money. And I said, oh, Gene, I'll just come in and do it. I said, it'll be fun. So I went in and helped with the monologue. And then like Tuesday or Wednesday, he goes, you know what? You're crazy. Cook up something and be on the show. And since I could do pratfalls, like we were talking about earlier with Sergio and me, I said, Gene, I'll do the National Safety Council and I'll come out and I'll trip. And we didn't tell anybody because you can't rehearse tripping, because I thought if I do a rehearsal and break my leg, then it'll never be on the air. So if I break my leg, I'd rather it be on video. So that's what I did. And it worked out very well.
Your website has many clips of different things that you've done for the end. You did something similar on Match Game where you when Lauren Bacall was on, actually.
Oh, Lauren Bacall was so funny. We had a lot of fun backstage. And I think one of the most memorable things about Match Game was I was talking to her in makeup and I said, Lauren, what do you think? And she said, Dick, call me Betty. My friends call me Betty. And I thought, oh my God, I'm calling her Betty. I'm her friend. and sometimes you look back and you think, I asked her once, I said, Betty, why are you doing an instant coffee commercial? Do you remember that?
Yes.
Yeah. She said, oh, that's easy. She said, it was 3 hours work and it paid $250,000. I said, oh my God. Yes, that's a good job. Yeah.
Well, the funny thing is you had many in the 60s version. You had many Hollywood celebrities come in.
Oh, you know, yes.
Unheard was, of.
I know. What we would do, I had a friend there in booking, Ray Pichon, who unfortunately passed away recently. I said, let's book all the celebrities we wanted to meet. And like, we wanted to get Mae West. And Ray tried a bunch of times. And she said, you know, here's the agent's name. Call him. Maybe since you write the questions, he'll feel differently. So I called the guy and we spoke for a while. And he said, Dick, listen, you sound very sincere about this, but let me just tell you what's going on here. Mae is legally blind. She won't wear glasses. She only grants interviews for people to come here in her living room. She knows every piece of furniture. She can walk around the room not being able to see and know where everything is and look like her vision is fine. She's not going to go on any appearance. But he said, I thought you should just know that we're not doing this to spite. And so that was someone that we couldn't get. But to get Gloria Swanson, I couldn't believe. I could not believe it.
Well, the 70s version of Match Game got canceled after 9 years. It was brought back a few times afterwards. But it, like we just mentioned before, it never really seemed to recapture the magic from the 70s. But you worked on it. Did you find working on it very different for yourself as well?
Well, the version that came back with Alec Baldwin was nothing to do with, you know, on the earlier version of Match Game, you would say, you know, Mary liked to pour gravy on John's blank, and you would think dirty and answer something like potato. But on the Alec Baldwin thing, they would just say, on his Johnson, on his pecker. His balls, the first couple of weeks, I thought, there's no innuendo here. They're just putting the words on the card. But that had nothing to do. And then there was a version in Canada. But I got a call once or twice, and I just said, ma'am, somewhere there are probably 100,000. I wrote 40,000 questions.
Oh my God.
In those 9 years. And I only know because we never knew how to file match game questions. If you file them under John and Mary, you don't just need two filing cabinets, a J and an M. So we numbered them. And then when we got, I was numbering 29,800. And I said to Gene Kobelman, I said, Gene, why are we numbering these things? So she said, all right, just start doing them. And then we, for a short time, we wrote the celebrities' names. You know, do I have a, let me just, oh, this is very funny because I was talking to someone about this. Here is, let me see. You know, for some reason,
wow.
When I talk, my camera does not come up.
It's showing there, I guess.
Oh, okay. So this is an original match game card.
Wow.
And it was question 13,959. Okay. It was played, oh, Jane Mansfield and Bennett Cerf. What a combination.
Wow.
And it was on the taping of 3/9/1966. And I've told it many times, but do you know the Jane Mansfield story on Match Game? I can make it real quick.
No, let's hear it.
Okay. So one of my jobs was to go into the celebrities for the first time, to go in the dressing room, see if they needed anything, understand the game, wanted something to drink. So I go in and Jane has a stack of books. I said, oh my God, Jane, what are you reading? She said, well, I never finished college. And show business is nothing but waiting. So I'm working on getting my degree. And you need anything? No, I'm fine. So anyway, after the first show, I leave the studio to go to the men's room. Jane's at the elevator. I said, Jane, where are you going? She said, well, the show's over. I said, you're doing five. She said, no, they just booked me for one. I said, Jane, can you come back to the studio? Because I'll get canned if I let you go. She said, oh, yeah, yeah. So we go back and call her agent and give the phone. And Jane said, oh, I'm sorry. She said, but I don't have anything to wear. So all the women on the staff start swapping clothes with her. And Audrey Davis lent her a sweater. And Audrey said, when she gave it back to me, it was three times the size it was before I lent it to her. But I keep it because Jane Mansfield wore my sweater. So
That's fantastic. Yeah. Well, what would you say about where Match Game stands in game show history?
What would I say about it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was a huge part of match game history. The fact that people still watch it, the fact that, you know, I don't watch it anymore. I'm not even sure if it's on Buzzer or anymore.
It's still on. I still watch it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was an astounding thing. When I would be at a party or something and say, what do you do? I say, I write stuff for Mad. Men would say, oh my God, you write for Mad. But women would say, oh, you write for Match Game? Yeah, it was one of the shows that has lasted a long time with a very favorable memories from people.
It's an iconic show for sure. I mean, I actually still find myself getting annoyed by 50-year-old answers that took contestants
get. Yeah. Yeah, so that's very
funny. I have to say,
I was one of those young people. I wasn't in college or high school, but I was one of those young people that I watched it every day after school. I absolutely loved it. It was a big, big part of my life. So thank you so much.
I didn't realize Reform School had TV.
Just one TV. We all had to share it, but I
was. Oh, okay. One. Okay.
Yeah, there you go.
One of the things, I was looking on your website and it shocked me that you don't get residuals from any of that.
No, I have one. Yeah, the check is there on my website.
Right.
I got $1.12 from Match Game. And I called up and I said, $1.12. So is that every week? Or the person said, no, it's forever.
Oh, my God.
That's, and that's and horrendous. I got 79 cents for Family Feud.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah.
It's horrendous. Wow. Really horrendous. Yeah.
So much for retiring on residuals.
Yeah, exactly. Well, tell us about your podcast, The Daily Gizwiz, which has been going on.
Now it's called just The Gizwiz.
Oh, The Gizwiz. Okay.
Yeah. Right. No, that's okay. It used to be every day of the week on a network called TWiT, This Week in Tech. And then the editor said, can you not just do 5 gadgets in one show so we don't have to edit? anyway, The Gizwiz started indirectly because of Goodson Todman. There was a woman there, Barbara Griff, one of the producers on To Tell the Truth, left Goodson Todman to our local station here owned by Metro Media, Channel 5. Mm-hmm. And she called me and she said, you know, is your office still full of weird gadgets? And I said, yeah. She said, did you ever think about coming on television and showing them? And I said, no, but I'll do it. It sounds like fun. So I went over, the show was called Saturday Morning Live. And they had a pet person and a gardener and a cook and a handyman. And I showed some gadgets. And a couple of weeks later, she said, you know, we got male people like this. Can you do it again? And I did. And then she said, can you do it every week? So I said, why not? And then I got a call from the Regis and Kathy Lee back then. Mm-hmm. Can you do gadgets for us? Were you under contract to them? And I said, no, I can do it for anybody. So I started with Regis, and then I went over to Good Morning America for 5 years. And now I'm on World News Now, the overnight news once a month. And that led to the loving gadgets. And then I met Leo Laporte, who owned TWiT. And he said, you know, I do a weekly show and a monthly show. I want to do a daily show. Can you do that? And I said, okay. And that started The Daily Gizwiz, and then it became The Gizwiz. And then it became listener supported because it was hard selling ads. I wasn't crazy about doing ads anyway. But it's very funny because this month, I'm starting year 19.
Amazing.
So for a podcast, that's pretty unique that something would run 19 years.
Amazing. Yeah, it really is. Going back to Mad, you wrote your memoir, you know, Good Days in Mad.
Yes.
Which I ordered this week, by the way. So were there any things, what prompted you to write it? And were there any things that started coming back to you that you had forgotten about?
Well, I met a guy called me, who's an agent for a publisher. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, now that Bill's dead, would you think about writing a book? And I said, I don't want to write a book. I said, you know, a movie satire is like 7 pages max. No. And so nothing happened. And then a couple months later, he said, let's have lunch again. I said, okay, but I don't want to write a book. And this time he said, you know, if you wrote a book, it would keep the memory of William Gaines alive. Mm. And I said, you know what? You just said the magic words. I said, because that would be great. I said, okay, I will do it. And it was he was very good. Actually, he was representing me. He didn't work for a book publisher. And so we got 2 offers for the book, one from a big publisher. And that meeting went like, Dick, we have a lot of people on staff and we have comedy editors who can help you along. And I thought, oh, dear God. And then I went to another publisher back then. I think they were out of business now, called Thundermouth Press. And this guy said, Dick, your book would be a feather in our cap, and you can do whatever you want. We have an editor who will just edit for possibly grammar, but this editor knows how to edit in your voice. So these were all the right things that this mm-hmm. publisher was saying. And so I went with them, because a book publisher who thinks you're going to be helped along by their comedy editors doesn't make sense. They don't know MAD. In it, I just related many stories with Gaines, the most famous of getting him into the Statue of Liberty in the middle of the night. We'd go shopping every other month, Bill and his wife Annie at the time, and I'm married to a guy, Dennis. And Annie was the original GPS. Bill couldn't see well. Annie could see great. Bill didn't do directions, but had a driving license. Andy couldn't drive. So it took the two of them to drive us to New Jersey to the supermarket. We're always terrified. Thankfully, we to get home. Well, just to buy stuff, because stuff in New Jersey was way cheaper than New York City. And over the years, Billy and I just became great friends. And he was an amazing person. He would do, one day he said to me, write down Saturday. It was like months in advance. And we had this love hate fun thing go on. I said, is this something I can invite Dennis to? He goes, let's put it this way. I'd rather Dennis came than you, but since you're like this, you have to come along. So it was to meet at Penn Station, which we did, and they announced the train to Boston. It's just 12 of us. And she says, go down the platform and don't get on the train. And I go, okay. I said, Billy, if this train's going to leave without us, he said, just wait. And we hear another train whistle, and out of the tunnel comes a little switch engine pushing an 1890s observation Pullman car, and they hook it up to the metro liner. And Billy said, this is the surprise. He said, especially you, because you're a train freak. There are three chefs aboard. We're going to have a champagne breakfast. We're going to go to Boston. They're going to put this car on a siding. You guys go into Boston for 5 hours. I'm going to stay on the train. And then we're going to have a sit-down, seven-course meal with matching wines. It was like just not a business expense. He just did it. He was freaking amazing.
Oh, unbelievable. What are you working on next?
Right now, I just do my podcast every week, mm-hmm. and I do a silly show called Giz Fizz on Wednesday or tonight, which is we play match game on it, and we caption photos, and I find old movies that they showed in school when you were a kid, like, do you know how important your mom is? Things like that. And we just play those, and anybody in the chat room can make snide comments about the movie. I stop by a lot of the Facebook fan, there's the Tell the Truth fan page, and there are like five MAD fan pages. So I try to stop by those
How upsetting, I mean, that MAD, when they ceased doing all the new issues.
Say it again, how?
When MAD magazine stopped doing all the new material.
Oh, it's very depressing.
Yeah.
Because no, when Mad buys something, they own it outright. The good thing, when Bill died, it was terrible. They cut the writers' rates by 40%. They stopped all paperback books. And I had 10 paperback books out there, which was a substantial part of my living. They just said, no more paperback books. And the good thing for the artist, I assume the artist got a pay cut too, but I'm not sure. The artist keeps their work. So they could they could not reprint it or sell it to like a publisher, but they could sell it privately. And so like Drucker and Davis, they usually had outstanding highest bid from like George Lucas and Steven Spielberg if the artwork was a cover that was their movie, you know, a cover covering their movie. It was very, and every once in a while someone writes me and said, well, you shouldn't still promote Mad because you get no money. I just like the fact that it's still keeping Mad's, Bill Gaines' image alive.
And people don't realize how big Mad Magazine was at one point. It was just such a cultural,
thing. Monstrous. We talked about the Poop Side Down adventure. Yeah. Sold over 2 million copies.
Mm. Well, just one more question about the Match Game. Out of all the time in Match Game, do you have like a favorite celebrity that came on frequently?
Oh, well, yeah, Lauren Bacall. You saw that clip, right?
I did see that clip. Yeah. Yes, that was a great clip.
And we were joking backstage, and she came out and she sat down, and she was still laughing about something, and I was sitting. I would sit about 3 feet from Gene Rayburn, and I had the Match Game, these yellow cards that you see. I had a stack of them. And I was on the headset with Gene Kopelman in the control room. And we would talk. And, you know, if they were doing terrible, Gene would say, what's on the board that's easy? And I would say, how about we just do a roses, a roses, a roses, a blank? They're sure to match. And then I would hand the card to a stagehand. It's very funny. The stagehand would take the card, put it in a big paper clip, bend it down a little, put it in this little wooden tunnel, and then with a stick, push it through, and it would pop up at the desk. Meanwhile, as he was pushing it, the sound effects guy would grind an old cash register like a machine. And then when the question got to the end of the tunnel, it would automatically pop up because it was just curled over. He would hit a bell, a ding. So that was how technically advanced that show was. Anyway, so Rayburn is talking to her and she's still looking at me. And Rayburn says, you know, Lauren Bacall is enamored with Dick DiBartolo. And I saw the red light go on that the camera was on me, and I fake fall, and that gets a laugh. And so I fall again, but knock all the questions on the floor. So that's my very favorite show.
That's a great clip. Yeah. Now, do you do any fan conventions at all?
Yes. Fan conventions are very depressing for writers. seriously. I remember at San Diego, I'll never forget as long as I live. I saw it's why I guess I stopped going to conventions, is this girl runs over and goes, oh my God, Mad Magazine, what do you draw? I said, well, I don't draw, I write. And she said, oh. And then her girlfriend comes over and says, what does he draw? And she turns to her friend and says, No, he's just a writer. So for the longest time, people say, what do you do at MAD? I go, I'm just a writer. It's because it was only Bill Gaines who, we were in an interview together, and the woman said, you know, you're a genius. And Bill said, no, I'm not a genius. If I've done anything to make MAD successful, it's to provide an atmosphere in which the writers and artists can thrive. And that's what Billy did. You could do whatever you wanted in the office. It was when Bill died, Time Warner came over and said, this looks like a high school newspaper. And we were thinking, oh yeah, great. Yes. That's what we were going for. And they said, this is all going to change. So that's why being a writer is not a big deal to most people.
Well, it is to us, and we want to thank you so much for coming on today. And both Mad Magazine and Match Game were big parts of both our childhoods, and it's such a pleasure to get to speak with you.
This is great fun. It's super. Doing interviews with people who really know the things you're talking about. I know I'm in for a horrendous time when the interview starts with, what's that little guy on the cover? Is it like Freddy? And I go, dear God,
oh, no.
Please let there be a power failure. And did you know that there some MADs now currently have original covers?
Yes, I did see that. They're putting new things on, right?
Exactly.
So again, Nick, thank you so much for coming, and it was really our pleasure to get to speak with you.
This is great fun. Thank you so much. You guys too. Thanks.
Pop Culture Retro. I'm Jonathan Rosen with Ike Eisenman. And again, a very special thanks to Dick DiBartolo. And please like, comment, and subscribe.
Thank you for listening to Pop Culture Retro, where no one was hurt during the making of this podcast.